That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
And now, are you effing kidding me? With JoJo from Juries.
I am so sick and tired of Trump whining about how hard it is to sit in court. Brian Sicknick doesn't get to complain about a cold courtroom. Neither do the Capitol Police officers who've taken their own lives since that attack. The more than 1 million Americans lost to COVID, hundreds of thousands of which we can attribute directly to his actions and inactions, would love to whine about having to spend a few hours without their cell phones, if it meant they weren't also dead. But Trump doesn't care about any of them. He's a horrible fucking excuse for a human being, and he has never spent a tenth of a second of his spoon-fed, spoiled existence thinking about, let alone caring about, the suffering of another human being. And if he ever does think about it, the reason is he's taking pleasure in it, like the sociopath he is. But I will say this, I am glad it's hard for him. If that's wrong, so be it. I don't care. What these trials continue to lay bare is what we've always known. Everything about Donald Trump is a con. From his deck-stained skin and 15-step comb-over to his gilded tower, his real estate acumen, his electoral success, his billions, and his birther mail-order bride. It's all fake, a ruse, a scam. He's not a self-made billionaire. He's a nepotistic fraud who squandered his daddy's money, cooked the books, and cheated the government. He's not a family man. He's a serial philanderer. His family won't even show up at court to support. He didn't win the 2020 election, despite all the ways he cheated, and he only won in 2016 because of all the ways he cheated. His entire existence has forever been predicated on lies. Lies he doesn't want anyone to talk about ever. And no matter how many times he does his accordion hands, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, he knows we see him. His distortions are his reality, but that doesn't mean that he's not aware of what's hiding behind the curtain out of view from everyone, especially himself. He knows that he doesn't want to look at the gadgets and gizmos, thingamajigs, knobs, and levers at work to maintain the fiction. And he certainly doesn't want anyone else to see them either. To a narcissist like him, these are mortal wounds. He is a fraud, a powerless, daddy-funded phony, and a cheater who relies on literal fake news to win. For someone like him, the process of unveiling the truth of who he really is and all the manipulations it takes to keep the lies intact is a fate worse than death. And yes, he's out there acting like this gag order is a gulag, and it's fucking ridiculous. But frankly, when it comes to him finally facing true accountability, this is at the very least a start. My guest this week is Olivier Knox. Olivier has covered politics and foreign policy for 3 decades, most recently at the Washington Post, where he anchored the daily 202 newsletter. He joined the Post from Sirius XM, where he was chief Washington correspondent and hosted a live 3-hour show each weeknight, focused on politics, foreign policy, and quirky corners of the federal government. Before that, he reported for Yahoo News and hosted a weekly Yahoo-branded radio show. In addition to news, Olivier dug into a range of politics-related features, including how a presidential phone call gets made and what presidential hotel stays look like and feel like from the inside. Olivier got his start as a reporter at Agence France-Presse. I said that wrong. I'm sorry, Monsieur Salamé, for which he eventually covered all 8 years of the George W. Bush administration. From July 2018 to July 2019, he was president of the White House Correspondents Association. Olivier, who was born to an American father and a French mother, bounced between Middlebury, Vermont and Paris, France during his first 18 years. He is a native speaker of French and a fluent speaker of Spanish. I didn't know that. He lives in Bethesda with his wife and their son. I've known Olivier for many years, and I've never had a conversation with him quite like this one, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. He has some incredible stories to share about what it was like to cover the Bush White House, Congress during Bill Clinton's impeachment, 9/11, and so many other hugely historical moments in time. Welcome to the Are You Effing Kidding Me podcast, Olivier Knox. Hi, Olivier.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much. Great to be here.
I'm so glad to talk to you. I have a million trillion questions for you, but I think we'll just jump right into it because from your very long and storied career as a journalist covering mostly Washington, D.C., right? Essentially, have some stories. We have some serious stories. One of those stories involves not one, but two sneakers being hurled at George W. Bush. You were there for that. Why don't we just jump in right there? How did you get to that place? Not like on a plane or physically, but like, how'd you wind up there? What was it like being there? What are your memories of it?
Sure. So it's 2008 and George W. Bush's presidency is winding down. I've covered him since Inauguration Day for Agence France-Presse, the oldest and third largest international newswire. And the Bush White House was very mindful of the fact that AFP reached a global audience. And so when it came time for President Bush to do sort of a farewell swing through Iraq and Afghanistan, they invited me along. Now, typically when a president travels to places like that, they bring what's called the pool, which is a group of 13 photographers, camera folks, correspondents from radio, TV, print, digital, et cetera. Well, they added a couple people to the group, including me. And so we flew in the dark of night, having been prohibited from discussing the trip with anyone other than one editor and our spouses. Flew in the dark of night, landed in Baghdad, motorcaded to this government building where they'd set up in the lobby. They'd set up a bunch of chairs, two lecterns, couple of chairs. And so think of it as like a wedding layout. So you have at the top of this room, you have the lecterns where the president and the prime minister of Iraq are going to speak. You have, I don't know, maybe 5 feet of space. And then on two sides, you have the Iraqi news media and the U.S. news media. And then in the back, you have a riser with cameras. Okay, that's the layout. And the layout's important for this story. So we get into this process and Prime Minister Maliki and President Bush are talking. And all of a sudden, this black object just sails over my head. And my first reaction is to think, is that going to go boom? And then I realize, oh, it's a shoe. Someone just threw a loafer at President Bush. And then a second one sailed overhead. And after I'd quickly peeked and I'd seen that it was an Iraqi reporter who was basically across the aisle and across the aisle, one row behind me. And after he threw his second shoe, he was tackled by a combination of Iraqi security and Iraqi journalists. He was beaten up pretty badly, dragged off behind a door. And we could hear him moaning for parts of the rest of the press conference. Now, the reason the layout is important, remember the bride and groom back?
Yeah.
Is that normally the Secret Service would have come in a space between the chairs and the riser, but there was no space between the chairs and the riser. So they had to come in through the front and that delayed them.
Jesus.
So they were pretty ticked off by that. He was beaten badly enough that there was blood on the carpet. And the thing is, if he'd waited another 5 minutes, George W. Bush and Nouri al-Maliki would have been sitting in these really high-backed chairs. And instead of sort of ducking out of the way, Bush would have had nowhere to go. So that would have been a much worse set of facts. Now, throughout this incident, all of the U.S. press corps, we were all keeping our eyes on George W. Bush because that's our job, right? Our job is to cover the president.
Yeah.
So there's an unfortunately deeply unflattering photograph of me as Muntasir al-Zaidi is releasing the second shoe. Evan Vucci of the Associated Press got a photo, and I'm in the corner of the photo doing something like watching Bush. So that's the shoe throwing of Baghdad. It was a pretty one of the wildest things that I saw in my 3 decades as a journalist. I mean, it was really utterly unexpected, unless you were an Iraqi, because I talked to the local AFP reporter who said, "Oh yeah, that's Muntasir al-Zaidi. He's been saying for months that if he were in the same room with George W. Bush, he would throw his shoes at Bush." So somebody knew that this was coming.
It seems as though maybe the Secret Service that wasn't close enough to him should have probably flagged that, right? Maybe?
Yeah, well, what actually, so the way presidential travel works is what should have happened is there should have been a U.S. State Department advance person. Advance is basically a fancy way of saying logistics. Mm-hmm. There should have been a State Department logistics person who looked at the layout and said, no, we can't have the risers with the cameras abutting directly with the seats because we need different channels to be able to get into that space if necessary.
Mm-hmm. Would they have been able to stop the first shoe? Certainly not certainly the second maybe, but the first, no?
It seems unlikely that they would have been able to do that because, you know, he basically unlaced his shoe, took his shoe off and threw it. So There wasn't a lot of time to adjust. But the second one, they probably could have done something about. But you know, they're not in the frame of the camera, right? So it's not like they're next to the lectern ready to jump out.
Yeah.
Stop something like this. They are off in not exactly the wings. Everyone in that room has been screened. You know, we've been screened to death, because we are allowed to get within arm's reach of the president. Mm-hmm. The Iraqi folks have all gone through metal detectors. They've been confirmed by the prime minister's office. So it's not like there was zero security, zero screening. There actually was. It just failed to catch someone whose plan was to lob a couple of, black lace-ups at the president.
It's silly that he chose lace-ups and not loafers, you know, in retrospect. Probably should go with loafers, but it's funny because I think there's a whole segment of the population, because I'm old, and I'm not going to say you're old, although you're older than me, so you're officially old, but that doesn't remember that, right? So, or no, probably, maybe they do, but they certainly don't remember it. And to like try and describe, I showed the picture to my own kids who were 14 and 11. My son said that you, ready for this? No, you boy. Looked like you had a British accent.
That's very funny.
And I said, actually, it's French, but he does not have a French or British accent. Although I think you could probably easily switch into what would sound like a French accent.
I could definitely do a French accent.
I don't know how your British accent would be, but you don't have to try.
But I appreciate that.
Yeah. But that's the thing. Like, the thing, like, when that happened, it was so crazy as an American citizen, first of all, but certainly I'm sure as a reporter, like it's still like, wait, did that just happen? And Bush was, again, that's another thing they don't really understand because they didn't live through him. He was just a kind of cavalier guy about the whole thing. Like he was sort of like, whoa, dodge it. And he was like, whoa. And then he said, it's all right, I guess, to the Secret Service in the clip. I mean, it's so completely surreal imagining anything like that happening now.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I mean, that's basically been my career. You know, like I started out, I think it was a week or 2 weeks after I started out, there was the TWA Flight 800 crash into the waters off Long Island. My first proper reporting assignment, I was made a congressional correspondent in January of 1998, basically right as the Lewinsky story was blowing up. So my first really proper in-depth assignment was the Clinton impeachment. Then I covered Al Gore's presidential campaign in 2000. We all know, well, I guess maybe we don't all know, that ended up with a crazy recount in the state of Florida. Then I went to cover the Bush White House. We had 9/11, Afghanistan, Iraq, the global financial crisis. The president choked on a pretzel, lost consciousness, and fell on his face. So, you know, I feel like there's been this sort of running theme of I can't believe this is happening, or you have to be effing kidding me, to put it in a different way.
Right. But that's the goal, right? So that's why you go to, we'll talk about this too. That's why you go to all the stuff that everybody's like, oh my God, we have to go watch Bush go to a school in Florida. And like, this is, what's the point, really? A lot of people could have said that, but you're there, you are at a school in Florida, not in the room with him at the time, but on 9/11, you were traveling with the president for what would have been a mundane visit and turned into the most, arguably historic moment, and certainly in my lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, no one on that trip, and this is back in the era when news outlets had money, and so you would do these ostensibly pointless trips. So my outlet AFP paid for me to have a seat on the press charter. Back then there was a press charter that would go ahead of Air Force One. They paid for me to go on the press charter. They paid for my room in the block of rooms that the press corps had. They paid for, you know, the catering in our filing center, which is the space where all the reporters work, knowing that this was going to be a newsless event. It was going to be a domestic event focused on education, no new announcements, no special initiatives. But there was there's sort of a rule in White House coverage. It's called protective coverage. Protective coverage is basically what if. And so I was down there. I was in the filing center, watching Bush on the TV screens that were in the filing center. And all of a sudden on the news, on the AFP wire, there's a block of red text that says plane hits World Trade Center. And the Associated Press had the same flash, Reuters, same flash, Bloomberg, same flash. And so we were all started talking at once. And we thought, in the initial minutes, we thought, oh, is this going to be another one of those dumbasses in a Cessna who decides to fly, you know, among the buildings in Manhattan and screws up? Well, we finally got the TV side of the filing center to put the World Trade Center images on a screen. So we had Bush on one TV and the World Trade Center on the other. And it was immediately obvious that it was not a Cessna. It was actually a very large plane that had hit that first tower. And so that changes our response. We're now emailing the White House spokespeople saying, what do you know about this? What's going on? And then we watched the second plane hit the second tower live, at which point that changes the story again. Now it's obviously a coordinated attack. And so we watched that happen. A couple minutes later, the White House Chief of Staff, Andy Card, hustled into the room where the president was speaking to elementary school children, leaned in and whispered. History records that he said a second plane has hit the World Trade Center. America's under attack. So then the president basically finishes his event, packs up. They ground all the air traffic all over America. And we hear about the Pentagon. We hear about the field in Pennsylvania. And then the president sort of did this hop, skip, jump from Sarasota, Florida to one military base, another military base, and ultimately back to the White House. And so instead of sitting on my butt enjoying way too many Diet Cokes from the catering area, I spent a day chronicling what the president of the United States was doing in the face of this unprecedented attack, you know, watching his televised statements from these military bases, chronicling his travel, getting reports from, I think at the end of the day, it was just one reporter on Air Force One instead of the usual 13. I believe it was just Ann Compton of ABC Radio, a supremely talented journalist, but taking her feed, incorporating it into our stories. And then we had to figure out, what do we do next? And ultimately, I think it was 24 hours later, the press corps decided to rent buses. And we drove the 22 hours or whatever it was from Sarasota to Washington, D.C. Most of us woke up near dawn when we were passing the Pentagon, which was still smoldering. And that is sort of my 9/11 story in a nutshell. That I should add, of course, that I was hearing from family, friends, like the Swiss AFS kid from my junior year in high school reached out. I mean, it was just everyone, because there were people knew that I was covering the president, so they knew that I was probably with him. Mm-hmm. And so they checked in a lot. But obviously that was, you know, arguably the most momentous thing that I've ever covered.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I didn't realize, I knew you had the TVs on, but I guess I never made the connection that you were watching Bush and the live feed of the Trade Center at the same time. That's so surreal because, I mean, no one else really in the world would have had those two things juxtaposed in quite that way at that moment. But yeah, and everything did become crystal clear when we saw the second, and we clearly all knew it was a jet because nobody was really watching for the first one. But well, many of us, like I said to you separately, I heard my alarm went off. My news, my radio alarm was always set to the news. And it went off and, you know, they said, oh, we think a small plane, again, you know, has inadvertently run into the World Trade Center. And I was like, oh, not this again, because there had been a story not that distant in the past where something like that had happened or almost happened or something like that. And so the news thought, the newscasters thought that that's what it was. And so I turned my TV on and I was watching the television just the same way you just described and saw the second. And my then boyfriend, now ex-husband, had left the windows on the world like 8 months prior. He worked as a cellar rat there. So, and I knew tons of people who worked there because I just moved out of the city as well. And it was just absolutely surreal. But in that space of that moment, we knew we were under attack, really. There couldn't be any other conclusion to draw.
Right. And it wasn't that long after that, that Osama bin Laden's name started being floated as the likely architect of the attack. I mean, I had national security sources saying, well, the first wave was only analytical. There was no evidence, but the early analysis was the most likely person, the most likely group is Al-Qaeda led by Osama bin Laden, because we know they've been trying to plan a large attack in the US. And so they're the most likely people. So it actually came together pretty quickly. And then, you know, from there, of course, we get the American response, the back and forth with the Taliban about whether they'll hand over bin Laden. And ultimately we get the American military operation in Afghanistan, you know, which becomes America's longest shooting war. You know, unless you are a stickler and consider the Korean conflict not over, and therefore that would be the longest one. But anyway, longest shooting war in any case. And of course, Bush decides to take the country into Iraq. So 9/11 was an enormously momentous event, and it was an entirely surreal thing to be covering. I mean, I never expected. I mean, keep in mind that just a few years earlier, I'm covering, you know, graphic a report that goes into graphic detail about a president's sex life.
Right.
With a former intern. So I guess I can't say that I'd never, you know, expected to cover something strange, but this was strange and momentous. And I'm writing in English for an audience overseas, which is another difference. So I'm writing a lot about foreign policy. That's my area. And so 9/11 was this incredible overlap of domestic politics, foreign policy, national security, you know, society. It was an incredible storm of news.
And we don't think often enough, or I don't think often enough, about how the rest of the world sort of absorbed 9/11. You know, I mean, I think about it, obviously, as we all do, in terms of how it impacted me, what I remember, you know, living in the city, seeing those firemen walking to work. I was walking to work, passing one of the firehouses where I believe they lost everyone. But what was the world thinking? You know, what were the French in particular thinking at that moment?
Right. There was a wave of sympathy in France for the United States. Keep in mind that the French had a longer history with terrorism on their soil. They had the radical left-wing groups in the 70s and 80s. They had Islamist extremists in the 80s and 90s. And so they understood this experience. Some years ago, before 9/11, I want to say 1995, a group of Islamists hijacked a jet, and a French jet, and forced it to land in Marseille to refuel. And at the time, we learned later that the intel the French had was that they wanted a fully fueled plane, and they wanted to fly it to Paris and crash it into some major building in Paris. So, you know, there was this big wave of sympathy. This is a little bit sad. There was, we were in New York a few weeks after 9/11, I want to say for the UN General Assembly in late September. And we were some of my colleagues and I were in this bar, and there were these four or five very fit young men in uniforms at the bar. And none of us recognized the uniforms. We're like, man, it's not Marines. It's not Army. It's not Navy. It's not Coast Guard. It's not National Guard. Who are these guys? And it may surprise you that I'm among the least shy people in our little cohort of reporters. Hmm. So I walked over and I said, excuse me, guys. You know, we've been checking you guys out, like your uniforms. What uniform is that? And it turned out to be French firefighters. And so I switched to French and I'm like, wow, that's really great. You guys, like, I had no idea you were here. And one of them taps the other on the shoulder and he says, see, they were really sad that Americans and they have French, half American, had not realized that this whole group of French firefighters had immediately volunteered to fly over and help the American, emergency responders go through debris, put out fires, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a little bit of a sad story, but it just goes to show, like, it was really, there was really a wave of sympathy among the French people for the United States.
Yeah, that's incredibly powerful. And I confess that I did not know that either. And it is sad, but I am grateful. So thank you to them. It was also such a unifying time in this country, which is so strange. We had this minute of time where everyone was flying flags. We had flags on our cars. It was like everything else, every difference seemed so trivial and minute for this second in time. And it takes, unfortunately, a tragedy, you know what I mean, of that magnitude for that to happen. But I feel like it, and that's another thing that even unless you lived it, you really can't explain it or articulate it to anyone.
Well, especially because the young folks today have grown up in a country that more regularly flies the flag. Mm-hmm. You know, until 9/11, the place where I had seen the most American flags was Normandy, because the people of Normandy are eternally grateful for D-Day. And so at any time, any point of the year, if you drove out from Paris to Normandy, driving through Normandy, you would see American flags kind of everywhere. Mm-hmm. And until 9/11, I mean, I'd seen them on the 4th of July, obviously, but year round, I'd never seen more flags than I did in Normandy.
Right. And you're right. I didn't think about that either. Because I fly a flag, and you do. Most people up and down my street do. And before 9/11, that was not so much the case. Maybe it had been, you know, prior to me recognizing them or knowing, you know, what the significance was probably little. But certainly now it's very different, which is interesting because apparently we all hate America is what we're told anyway. All of us lives do anyway. But I want to talk about this idea of unity versus discord and dysfunction, because you covered Congress, like you said, and some very impactful years of Congress. And I want to see if you can sort of articulate the differences between the Congress that you covered and what we're looking at today. Because, I mean, I feel like they're vastly different. I would assume that you would maybe say the same, but I mean, I'm curious what your observations would be.
So the transformation of the United States Congress really goes to one person, Newt Gingrich, who in the 1980s was a backbencher who realized that the last order of business in the House legislative day are these minute speeches, basically. And he realized, oh, there's a camera on these speeches, people aren't really using these speeches. And so he used them for these really incendiary speeches. So he got a lot of attention for that, which meant he also got sort of a more like national fundraising base, gets into leadership and governs that way, right? And so he is, the young folks put it on Sarah Palin, the young folks are wrong. This is a Newt Gingrich project. Hmm. It was, so you couple that attitude with the internet and you get today's Congress, because in 1998, 1999, it was pretty easy to find individual House members who believed that Bill Clinton was ready to invite the UN military to invade America. It was pretty easy to find members of Congress who believed in the black helicopters flying overhead, doing scouting work for the one world government. Hmm. But they didn't come together. There was no unity among them because there was no real internet. It was the dawn of the internet. Now you are able to forge these kinds of communities online. And you're able to fundraise nationally really easily. You could not fundraise nationally really easily in 1998. Mm-hmm. And so some of the incentives change, and the incentives go from, I passed a really meaningful Social Security reform bill, to I just got 8 full minutes on Fox News or MSNBC, right? Mm-hmm. I could always be wrong. I don't expect we are going to remember Marjorie Taylor Greene as a giant of legislation.
You don't think
her
so?
Her incentives aren't there, right? She's got a national fundraising base for being controversial, incendiary, et cetera. Which is also why you're seeing more middle of the road Republicans leave the House. Mm-hmm. But that's really the gap. I mean, it was so easy to find really crazy, really nasty stuff in the Congress in 98, 99, but it just didn't have the kind of front and center importance because it didn't reach a national audience in the same way. Mm-hmm. And so now it does. Now it does reach a national audience. And of course you have the Trump effect where, you know, he can turn things around with a social media post, right? So he can kill the border bill with a social media post and a couple of phone calls. And that obviously changes how the House operates.
Right. Not at all surprising. The incentive structure is completely different. I mean, you know that they go out there for these clicks. I mean, again, it's not because they're legislating, but would you say in terms of being willing to work together across the aisle, that there's any differences now versus then, or were they really just as divided back then as they are now?
Let me see how I can phrase this. People underestimate the role that just raw power plays in Congress. You know, mm-hmm. People think of LBJ, right, Lyndon Johnson, as this master manipulator of the Senate, okay? Except that the minute he lost his majority, he got nothing. Mm. Right? He got a lot of achievements because he had a majority. And so we overestimate the ability of the president to get with what they want out of the Congress. In terms of working together, you know, interestingly, we have seen a Democratic-Republican majority pass some legislation of late, mm-hmm. right? The big aid bill for Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan and the I'll call it a TikTok ban, although some folks will object to that, the new restrictions on TikTok, I'll say. So you're seeing some interesting, it's purely of convenience, but you're seeing some work across the aisle. Historically, there are some interesting left-right coalitions that pop up on things like human rights. So when I was covering Congress in 98, 99, the most conservative House members and the most liberal House members would rally together to denounce China, for example. So Chris Smith of New Jersey, for instance, very, very, very conservative House member, and Tom Lantos, who was the top Democrat on the House, then House International Relations Committee, they would come together and agree that they had to criticize China on human rights. An area where you see some left-right coalescing, although it hasn't really generated significant legislation yet, nothing that's passed anyway, is the left-right coalition on privacy and surveillance. Mm-hmm. So Ron Wyden, very liberal senator, Rand Paul, very conservative senator, both expressing concerns about the renewal of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and its warrantless wiretapping. Sorry. That hasn't generated anything sort of major in terms of reforms, or but it is, those are some areas to look at if you're looking for folks working across the aisle.
Mm, that is true. I mean, we did pass a bipartisan infrastructure bill, and I would say, again, Biden's been around longer than you, which is not by much, though. No, I'm just kidding. Which is definitely a testament to his ability, but also, you know, maybe some sanity prevailing. But so the differences in Congress, setting that aside, but sort of on the same theme, I want to talk to you about the differences in journalism and where people get their news, because you have a Substack called The Briefing Room. And in a recent essay entitled Where You Get Your News, you outline really the state of the news industry now versus where it's been. And so I'm very curious about this because it's very troubling to me. I'm curious about what you see as the changes, where we've come from where we are and where we're going. How can we maybe change this trend, or can we at all?
Well, that last one's a great question, and you would need a whole other podcast with me to talk about it. I would say, I mean, the big differences are, one, that every news outlet is doing everything. So when I started out, you had print and you had photo and you had TV and you had radio, and they didn't really mix. It was, you know, the CNN guy was going to do a TV hit. The Wire guy was going to type a story. And now everyone's doing everything. So if you go to CNN.com, you get video, audio, print, photo, et cetera. So that's one big change in sort of the way the news media does its job. The other big change, and this is something that too many in the news media have not taken the time to learn, is that if you're the Washington Post, your competition is not the New York Times. Your competition is literally anyone who makes content anywhere for the web or tubes. Mm-hmm. And the New York Times has figured this out, which is why you're seeing the New York Times do games, do recipes, do Wirecutter, their product review site. They sort of figured early on that they needed stuff that would help them compete with, you know, an Instagram account or compete with a podcast. And so that's a really big difference. There's one area, we, the news media writ large, did not anticipate this. And we have not done enough to correct it, but you know, Google News, Google takes the lion's share of advertising revenue. Like if you find a story via Google, they take the lion's share of the ad revenue. Mm-hmm. And so we've sort of sown the seeds of our own destruction. In terms of the way forward, and this will be a little quick. In terms of the way forward, you're going to see subscriptions come back. Paywalls are coming back. News outlets are going to be fighting with AI because people are now searching with AI. So they're saying, what's happening in Indonesia? Mm-hmm. And AI scrapes all the Indonesia coverage. So steals the Indonesian coverage and serves it up. So subscriptions are coming back. Tiered subscriptions are coming back. So, you know, the New York Times has figured out that getting 100% of your $3 is better than getting 0% of your $11. So they'll do like, you can just do Wordle. Mm-hmm. You can just do Spelling Bee. Or, hey, you can do this sort of a la carte kind of mix of things. Like you can get national news and Wordle. So that's a big trend. Print, actual physical print paper will be gone in 5 to 10 years. That audience is aging. And people are getting, one of the reasons that where do you get your news is so important, is that, you know, is your answer from my phone? Is your answer from an app? Is your answer from a podcast? If it's an app, are you getting news from an Instagram account that is stealing the CBS News reporting, or are you getting the CBS News report? Mm-hmm. All of these market forces are going to determine the trajectory of the news media in the next year, 5 years, 10 years. And you're going to see more things like Wirecutter. You're going to see more of these kind of partnerships. You know, the Associated Press just announced a deal with an e-commerce site. I don't remember which one now, but you're going to see more of that kind of relationship, because the news sites are increasingly, because they're competing with, again, everyone who makes content for the internet, they are having to diversify their product. You know, they can't just say, we've got the best White House coverage. That's not enough.
Right.
You need to be competing with, well, this will be an interesting state of affairs. The Washington Post needs to be competing with Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's complicated. And there's a courtroom dimension to this, which is that I sort of wonder how many news outlets are going to sue AI, how many news outlets are going to go to Google and say, no, you can't have 98% of our advertising revenue. You know, I wonder how much of the future of the media is going to be worked out in a courtroom. You know, Europe has been much more aggressive about limiting Google's ability to do this stuff. So I have a lot of questions about this. one other evolution, and this is a this is an Olivier theory. I don't know how accepted it is outside of, you know, my dining room. The news is increasingly going to be a talent proposition. People are going to be going to see and read Jake Tapper, not see and read CNN.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to go see and read April Ryan, not an outlet. They're going to go check out Peter Baker, not the New York Times. Increasingly, I think talent is going to matter because talent is where you can inject some voice into your coverage. And readers and viewers and listeners all now expect a certain level in intellectual rigor, factual rigor, but a more breezy style of writing and reporting.
Yeah. It's like casual Fridays all the time. But as someone who creates content on the interweb, I understand the double-edged sword that is my social media existence, my public existence, because, and it's worrisome in many ways, because what I always say is that I admit what I don't know, but there are people who don't maybe watch the news very much or read the news or listen to the news, and they go to their Twitter feed and they say, this is a person who I trust, and for better or for worse, that could be me in some cases. And I don't go out and find the stories either. Like, I'm not doing the one traveling to Gaza at the moment. I'm consolidating information from different sources that I trust. And that's very important to me too. But what worries me about my existence, actually, this sounds like a philosophical question, is that I don't want people necessarily to get their news from me. I really don't. I want, maybe if they want a rant or an opinion and they share it or don't, that's good. But what I'm worried about, because we've seen this, is these influencers who, some intentionally, some just because, have so much power that they can shift a narrative based on lies. We've seen that a lot with October 7th in particular. There was that whole TikTok Osama bin Laden thing that was manufactured by a Twitter influencer.
Right.
So that scares me because I don't want too many people to get their information from sources that aren't out there actually seeking the information. You know what I mean?
I do. One of the things that I don't know how we as a society handle is, you know, the news is now algorithmic, right? You see stuff that's like stuff you've clicked on before.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of a newspaper where you would like see the important story on A1, and then you'd turn the page and you'd see, I don't know, a science story that you never would have read, except that you're now facing it. And then you turn another page because you're going to that same important story, right? You turn another page and you're seeing like a report out of Norway that's really important. You're not getting that experience anymore. You're not getting exposed to the news broadly written. You're getting algorithmic news. And that part of that results in a public that is more cynical and angrier about life. And to say nothing of social media, I mean, Facebook, for instance, is a classic example of like, you know, making you angrier and angrier and angrier. So is Twitter in some ways. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know how, I don't know how to teach civics to a generation that has never known non-algorithmic news. It's a real challenge. I think it's a real challenge. I also haven't talked to a civics professor who might be able to tell me that I'm wrong, but I'm just not sure how we can get through that. You know, I see there, people talk about trust in media, and it's a complicated topic because there was an uptick after Watergate in trust in media, but we've never been, I mean, people talk about, you know, Walter Cronkite and the likes. And yes, it's true that network news, which at one time was really the only game in town, had solid trust. But we've not been much liked or much trusted for a pretty long time. And one of the things that worries me is less the impact of that diminished trust on us and more the impact of that diminished trust on what people are prepared to believe when they encounter it online.
Yeah.
You know, I have a bunch of followers who've been following me for years and years and years, and they'll ping me with some of the wildest stuff. celebrating that Tennessee bill banning, ostensibly banning chemtrails, right, which are not a thing. Mm-hmm. And saying, like, finally, someone is taking steps to reduce, you know, mind control via jet exhaust. Mm-hmm. And I come back and say, like, that's not a thing. And they're like, well, you're in the media. Like, why should we trust you? And that's where I get worried. Mm-hmm. It's not so much that I take it personally. It's that, you know, it creates this, this petri dish for chaos and for disinformation and misinformation. And I don't know how we solve that problem.
And it certainly doesn't help that this is an environment where the guy on trial for suppressing some truthful stories and creating, manufacturing false stories and publishing them in a fake magazine or fake newspaper like The Inquirer went around for the better part of the last decade plus calling all media, legitimate media, fake news, you know, and undermining every truthful story that existed while at the same time pushing all the lies that were being accepted as truth.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
There's a phenomenon I see among this little group of followers who message me, which is they trust the media just fine when the news story reinforces their priors. Uh-huh. So, you know, a news story that says, you know, credit card delinquency is at an all-time high, they're happy to share that. Mm-hmm. And they trust the news story in that moment. And he's the same way. He and his White House would happily print out news stories from the New York Times, the Washington Post, Yahoo News, which is where I was at the time, happily, and say, this is a great piece, you know, yay for this piece, yay for this journalist, when it reinforced their beliefs. I wrote a piece summer of 17, basically saying that Trump has the same problem that Obama had and the same problem that Bush had, which is, you know, how do you get out of Afghanistan? How do you declare victory? What set of circumstances would be victory and would let you come home? And I got a call from a very senior Trump aide who just gushed about the piece and said, right, there's no victory. We should get out, et cetera, et cetera. So they're sort of situational media doubters as opposed to blanket media doubters. But yeah, of course they've made sure that basically among their followers, a news story that is bad for Donald Trump is seen as biased against Donald Trump. And those two things are not the same.
And he walks around with, still to this day, he's been doing it in this trial. It's like a printer. I think of them as like a printer fluffer. Like, this person's job is to carry a printer everywhere he goes so they can print out these stacks, like to your point, of articles written by Tom Fitton or whomever that do support his point. And in those cases, that's good media. Those are the real journalists when they're not even really most of the time.
Yeah, but the more interesting phenomenon is when they're printing out the Post or the Times or CNN or what have you.
Yeah.
That's the more interesting phenomenon, right? Because he's declared these folks fake news.
Yeah.
But when they're reporting, and we are supposed to report without fear or favor. So yes, we sometimes report things that are bad for the current president. Happens. Mm-hmm. When we do that, then we are somehow the real news. Mm-hmm. And that's the phenomenon that I find sort of that's what complicates these conversations about trust in news.
Yeah.
Because so many Americans have decided that the news exists to reinforce their priors.
I think that's subconscious, right? Largely. But my worry also is that my kids, again, my son's 14. I'll just use him as an example because my daughter's a little young yet. He doesn't consume news. Not that all 14-year-olds do. I did because I was a dork. But he doesn't consume news in any traditional format at all. However, whatever it is that is in his algorithm on whatever app he's using at that moment, whether it's usually Instagram, I guess, actually, and YouTube, is feeding him news-ish stories. For instance, when Easter rolled around and it just happened to coincide with Transgender Visibility Day of Transgender Visibility, you know what happened with that story. Everybody knows what happened with that story, where the right hijacked the whole thing and created this false narrative that it was Biden choosing Easter to happen to be the day of transgender visibility, which obviously, if you have a calendar and a brain, you know that that's not true. And if you have vetted sources of information and all you have to do is go, oh, you know what? This date pre-existed Biden's presidency. And by the way, it's moving because Easter moves and this is why, blah, blah, blah. My son, we get in the car and he says, I can't believe Biden did this. Like, I'm all for them having a day of visibility, Mom, but this is a really bad look. And I was like, oh, what? And where did you get that? Which was, I was grateful that he told me that, because then it opened up a conversation where I was like, where are you getting your news? And it was coming from a social media feed. And it was like, okay, no, but let me tell you where you can go so that you can find actual facts and fact-based news. And that scares me.
Yeah. The other interesting slash worrisome dynamic is teens getting their news from Instagram. So my son is 18. He's an avid soccer fan. He follows a bunch of Premier League accounts. And every now and then, these Premier League accounts will drop a New York Times story in their feeds. Like the most read New York Times story will pop in the feed. And so he'll come home and I'll say, oh my God, did you see that thing? Did you see that story out of Iran? And he says, yeah. So we start talking about it. And then I get around to, where did you see that story out of Iran? Just out of curiosity. He's like, oh, it was in one of my Prem accounts. And, you know, at least they're stealing the good stuff. You know, they're actually informing their audience. But it's a very, I'm going to keep hammering away at this. When we talk about how the competition is everyone who posts anything on the internet, that's true for those guys too.
Right.
They can't be a one-stop engagement shop if they don't address the need for news. Hmm. Now, they're not paying for that news, which is a huge problem.
Yeah.
But they face some of the same cross-cutting pressures too. At least your son came to you with this concern, because, you know, what you mostly see across social media is, you know, an inflammatory claim that then just rockets around the internet, and, you know, the correction gets like 100 likes.
Yeah.
And that's true. I mean, you know, that's been true forever, except that the speed of social media is the speed of light. And so that's a very different thing.
And it's 24/7, 365 days a year. So it never stops. It never ends. And it just keeps compounding on itself. And it's one of those things, again, I beg content creators, whatever you want to call yourself, anybody who has a larger social media platform, anybody really, to do your due diligence as much as humanly possible. Because, like, I just think it's wildly irresponsible not to, if people are, for better or for worse, looking to you to be some sort of disseminator of the news because they don't want to engage with the news. Again, we see all sorts of stories, but October 7th in Gaza, and that one is always top of mind for me, because it was so dangerous and hateful and violence inciting and scary. And a lot of people were engaging with it as if it was all fact-based, and that's terrifying. I don't want that to continue to happen on any level. So, yeah, please, content creators. Also, like, what can the content creators or whoever, what can they do to help journalists, to actually help share the space so that it doesn't kind of cut them out of the equation? Not that that's happening entirely, but it feels like it's...
No, I mean, it's, you know, what you're doing is curating a news feed, in effect, right? And that's existed as long as there's been an internet. I mean, you know, one thing that's, this is in my essay, but one thing that I would promote is, you know, subscribing. It's kind of a, you know, and if not subscribing, then at least not deliberately undermining a news outlet that's reliant on subscribers. You know, we recently saw a news startup go under, and part of their business model was they had subscriptions to newspapers that have paywalls, and they would rewrite the biggest stories that were behind the paywall. It was like, it was a deliberate attempt to get traffic by undermining the revenue model for the other outlets. But that's, I mean, I'm currently an independent reporter, so I could probably editorialize, but like, don't do that. That's a thing you should do. You should not deliberately undermine. You know, I'm not a complete idiot. I know that no one's going to subscribe to all of these papers. Like, pick two.
Yeah.
You know, I, for personal sentimental reasons, I subscribe to two news outlets in Vermont, my home state, Vermont Digger and 7 Days Vermont. 7 Days Vermont, a couple of years ago, did absolutely the best opioid crisis reporting I have ever read anywhere. So pick a couple of like local or regional outlets, pick a couple of national outlets, and just encourage people to subscribe. You know, because that's really, that's where we're going. That's where this news industry is going. I would be, the ad revenue model is not sufficient. I should have said this earlier. One, in addition to becoming effectively airlines, you know, where like a couple bucks more gets you this, a couple bucks more gets you that, a couple bucks more gets you this third thing. You're gonna start noticing news outlets gathering more personal information from their readers. You're gonna see questionnaires when you subscribe. You're gonna see questionnaires that say, you know, where are you? What do you do? What level are you at? You know, maybe tell us your salary range. And you know, tell us one other thing that you're interested in, because the sort of broader ad model, I think, doesn't work. And so these outlets are going to need to be able to go to Mercedes-Benz and say, we have 80,000 readers in St. Louis who are all white-collar workers who make over $170,000 a year. And Mercedes-Benz is going to say, let's advertise. I think you're going to see more and more of that, which as a privacy person, I am of two minds about. But I think you're gonna start seeing more of that, because that's the only way that this advertising stuff really is gonna work in the future.
Yeah, you can't subscribe to anything without pick five different things that you would also be interested in, or five different songs, and it's like skip. I don't want to do this. Just give me this thing. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Okay, well, that was a lot of incredibly important and interesting information, but I'm going to pivot to the last portion of my podcast. So I always end my podcast with the rapid fire random question round.
Excellent. And
are you ready, Olivier, not Oliver, Knox?
I am in fact ready.
Okay, these are very serious, very hard-hitting questions with massive worldwide implications, just so you know. First question. By the way, my son, my 14-year-old, wrote three of these for me today. I was on a call with the Biden campaign, but he had to do something. He was work from or take your kid to work day, so I put him to work. But the first one I wrote, number one, why do you hate pandas? What's wrong
I think
with
pandas are wildly overrated, boring creatures who sit around munching bamboo and bask in the adoration of people who are like, white and black bears, how exciting. I'm not a panda person. They're vermin. I don't like pandas. They're wildly overrated.
just called them vermin?
I'm not a panda guy. I never have been, never will be. There was a time when people on what used to be called Twitter would send me panda videos just to get under my skin. And no, I've never been a fan. I've never been a fan. Like, give me any of the apes or monkeys. That makes me happy.
I'm sorry, but like an orangutan isn't cuddly and goofy and silly and topsy-turvy, and they're not gonna like roll down a hill and make you smile. They're just gonna do like orangutan things.
Way cooler. Way cooler than like.
Your panda impression. I don't know that that's what a panda looks like when he eats bamboo, but like show us on the panda stuffed bear where you got injured and inflicted with this trauma.
It's really mostly just contrarianism.
Yeah.
I feel contrary to the, I mean, living in DC,
Yeah.
you are bombarded with an incessant, pandaganda, like, and so I just had a reaction to it when I first moved to DC. My dislike for pandas, coincides exactly with my arrival in DC.
And you must have been one of the like two people on the planet who was excited when we lost when our pandas went they went back, right? The DC pandas, didn't they go back to China?
They were on loan and they went back to China.
Did you have a party? I mean,
I
it's
didn't have a party, but
twisted.
I may have made some, may have made some comments on social media.
I just I don't I don't you're broken. I'm sorry. I'm just gonna say that. I love pandas. I love pandas. I remember my 8th grade trip, they were there. And I think I might have shed a tear or more than one tear because they're just, I want to squeeze one. I just want to squeeze it. I mean, I get hating raccoons. Pandas, no. But you can be contrarian. Why don't you be puppies? Why don't you be pandas? Anyway, yeah, because it's a DC thing. I get it. Moving on. Oh, this is another sociopath question. Does toilet paper, do you hang it over or under?
Over,
Okay,
over.
okay. Here's a self-own. Probably not that secret, actually, to some people, because a couple of years ago, my son corrected me and said, "Mom, the toilet paper goes over. Why is your toilet paper under?" And I was like, "What's wrong with you? It goes under. You have to pull it from under. It doesn't. Why would you pull it from over?" And I put it on Twitter because I'm an idiot, and I was instantly destroyed. Uh-oh, I think I fucked up. So it is over. And I've never, ever not thought about it since then. So now I'm very conscious about it.
Well, then I'm glad I gave the right answer.
Yeah, your team over. There are under people out there. I was one. I know they exist. So we see you. And it's not your fault. But Olivier hates pandas, but he's at least team over. So we'll give you a good score on that one. Oh, okay. This is another question from Leo. What would you do first if you won the lottery?
Oh, that's a great question. I actually just went to buy a Powerball ticket today.
Oh, what would you do if you win? What do you do first if you win? And should I buy one?
If
Is
I
it New
win,
Jersey
if I
too?
win Powerball, the first thing I'm doing is I am calling my younger brother and telling him that my nephew's college education is paid I have three little French nephews. They are adorable. Their English is astounding, and on the off chance that they might decide in X number of years they want to get their schooling in the US, I would want them to know that that was something that they could do without a second thought. So that's what I would do
Oh my
first.
God. That is beautiful. Powerball. Come on. Make it happen. Those kids, they're adorable. They're French. They live in France. French
Yeah,
though.
they live in Paris. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
He's the smart brother. He's the smart Knoxville.
But those boys need to have American schooling paid for by their delightful uncle. How do you say Uncle Olivier? in French?
Well, what you do is you don't say Oncle Olivier, which is the actual Uncle Olivier. There's a there's a shortened affectionate term, Tonton. So I'm Tonton Olivier.
Stop it right now.
T-O-N-T-O-N, not like Empire Strikes Back. But yeah, Tonton Olivier.
Oh my God. So see, like, I just want an, I want a panda that's an uncle so that I can call it Tonton Panda. Tonton, whatever your name
terrible,
is.
Terrible. Yeah. Tonton Butterstick. But yeah. So, and, but actually they speak to me in both French and in English. It really depends on the topic. My brother speaks only English to them. And one of them is currently in an immersion school where they do half in English, half in French. Their English really is spectacular. But sometimes they'll switch to French, and I'm not really sure what topics trigger that. But they'll speak to me in either language, and they get a kick out of the fact that I can go with them kind of, you know, in French or in English.
Yeah. That brings up two quick comments. One is that I, got through 4 years of French in high school without learning any French because the professor was Lebanese and I'm Lebanese and he grew up in Beirut like my dad did. And so he felt like some kind of need to protect me and keep passing me, even though he hated my fucking guts because I was the biggest brat on the planet and he did not want to pass me. I left 4 years of French being able to say, I think it's maybe, I don't know. Corbeil, garbage can. Is that how you say that? Yeah, I was like, je m'appelle André. That was my French name. And then I would say something with garbage can because I didn't remember anything else. But
yeah, corbeil is what you would call a trash can in a classroom.
Oh, well, then that makes sense. And it's obviously been very useful.
Because the actual big trash can outside is a poubelle.
A poubelle?
P-O-U-B-E-L-L-E.
Poubelle.
Poubelle.
Wait, they can even make the trash can sound good. But the other question I had related to this real fast is when you speak two languages, which one do you think in or does it change? Is it fluid or do you think in French or think in English and then speak in the other language? You know what I mean?
I do. So I grew up half in Vermont, half in Paris, and my dad ran the Middlebury College language schools. So they're these really intensive, you're only allowed to speak the language that you're studying. And there's this really, really important moment in your 7 weeks of undergraduate French instruction when you have your first dream in French. That is a moment when you know you've tipped into the more advanced French learning. For me, it's hard because I learned my multiplication tables in French.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't do 7 times 8. I can do 7 fois 8. But I can't do 7 times 8. And so I have to reverse engineer. Like if someone tells me what's 8 times 8, I have to go 8 times 8, 8 fois 8, 64. I cannot do it in English.
That's crazy.
And there are things like that. There are things that I learned as a kid that I can't do in English. I'm a little rusty right now because I haven't been a practicing Catholic for a while, but if you'd caught me when I was 20, I could have gone through all of Mass, but all of the call and response I could only do in French. And like I could never learn it in English. So it's kind of a long-winded way of replying to your ostensibly simple question, but it really depends. And in my dreams, sometimes people who speak only English in real life will speak French to me.
That's cool.
And with no accent and no nothing, just perfect.
That's so cool. Okay. The brain is a trip, man. This is why I'm glad my kids are learning. I think they're learning Italian on that, the doo-doo app, that one, what's it called? I don't remember. You know what I'm talking about. The language learning app that's like
a million of them.
Yeah, whichever one they're learning. I think their dad has them learning Italian. I don't know. I failed French, but well, I got through, but should not have. Thank you, Monsieur Salome. Monsieur. I can't even say it. Like what? Can't even
Monsieur.
Say it. Monsieur. My dad grew up speaking French, Arabic, and English, by the way.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. So when he would go to visit his cousins in Montreal, they would interchange all those languages as well. And the only one I barely understood was English, to say the least. Okay, last question from my son. Who was your first celebrity crush? Was it French or was it English? American?
Ooh, good question. I really liked the brown-haired daughter on Kate and Allie.
I'm like, that's a deep pull. Like, I loved Kate and Allie.
I don't remember her name.
Wasn't there a ginger daughter too? So it was like a ginger daughter. No offense.
Yeah, she's like strawberry blonde. Kind of strawberry blonde. Yeah.
I don't use that word despairingly. I love little redheads.
I think that was probably great question. I think that's who it was.
Wow.
And if you're out there watching and listening to this podcast, actress from Kate and Allie, I'm sorry that I can't summon up your name.
We can squeeze this information out of the sky in real time. Okay. Bear with us, folks, because I need to know now.
You're going
to
do Kate and Allie IMDb cast.
Yeah. Here we go. So, because I loved that show. Could it be Emma Myers? Because yes. Allison Smith.
No, it's Emma Myers.
Emma Myers, where are you? Are you still working? She's 55. Are you single? She's still very. Oh, that's right. Okay. Now I see the picture of her. She had the long, you can't see this, but she had the long, curly brown hair. This version of her? Yep.
She was a little bit different on the show, but yeah, sure.
I remember her. Okay. We need to find her. We need to find you. Maybe she follows you. Who knows?
Zero chance of that.
No, not a zero chance of that. Okay. We'll find her. But that is a very interesting deep pull. I wouldn't have ever thought about the TV shows I watched when I was a kid, because Michael Knight would have probably been up there, but it was Chris.
Yeah, you bet.
Yeah, but I had this weird thing with Christopher Atkins from Blue Lagoon. They used to show on Channel 11, and I was like, he didn't have a shirt on. I was like, I don't know why I feel weird. Anyway, on that note, okay, whew, you have your Substack again, the Briefing Room, right?
Yep, that's right. Yeah. And it's really a sanity exercise. I'm not doing a lot of like journalism. I'm looking to get back into journalism. But this is more about my sanity and about like some personal stuff. So I've written about the college admissions process. I've written about the movie Civil War. I've got one entry in there that's like the Frenchest thing ever, which I promise you is the Frenchest thing ever. So it's kind of a grab bag. I do have that essay on where do you get your news? And if you're interested in sort of the fate of the news media, have a look. It's just one insider's perspective, but I come by my beliefs honestly and through being a journalist since July of 1996.
And it's invaluable insight. It's instructive for the time period we're living in, but also what's coming ahead, to be able to look back. But also, I think it's great that, you know, your subsex more like, you know, the internal workings of your mind, and not necessarily constrained to being specifically like, you know, vetted journalism.
I'll get back into news sooner or later, and I will get back into doing the, you know, the headlines, the news stories, the analysis. I'll get back to that. This is really just a sanity exercise.
Good.
And people are free to disagree that it's working.
No, I think it's fantastic. And we need more sanity exercises. So I appreciate that. And I can't wait till you're back in the news too, because your show on Sirius was fantastic. And we need more of it, because you were like the newspaper in the way that you described it, because your show was anything you said you were curious about. And so it was like turning the page and being like, oh, I didn't know that this story was happening in Norway.
That was the idea. That was the idea behind the big picture. It was, I am curious about these things, mm-hmm. That are in the news. And I think my listeners will be also curious about these things, which served me actually pretty well. In like October, November of 2019, I started telling my listeners about this weird flu that China was having trouble containing. Come March, I had listeners pinging me on Twitter saying, you know, I'll never forget, you're the first person to bring the pandemic to me. You know, I sort of knew it was coming before any of my friends did. But it also got me like crazy fun interviews. I don't know if you remember the government's foremost expert on invasive species, who was really interesting. And I think I was the first reporter to, after Trump reached that deal with Kim Jong-un on the repatriation of American remains from the Korean War, I think I was the first journalist to interview one of the scientists at the Pentagon who does that stuff. which is really interesting, because one of the things they can do that they couldn't do when I was a kid is, based on the isotopes in your bones, they can tell which continent you were born on. And the best interviews I did were always the ones where half of my questions were, what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had Dr. Jay Varkey, epidemiologist from Emory University, during one of the Ebola flare-ups. And all the stuff, every time I would ask him these questions, and he would give me these answers, and half the time they were just impossible to believe. You know, like the one I remember best, because it's really the nastiest, was, you know, I said, well, why, what are some reasons that, you know, it's not a good idea to treat an Ebola patient at a regular hospital as opposed to a place like Emory, which has an infectious disease ward? And part of the answer was, well, an Ebola patient generates 300 to 400 times the medical waste of a regular patient.
Oh, wow. Holy shit.
So those interviews where I learned a lot. I mean, there's some interviews where I know what the answer is going to be.
Yeah.
The ones where I have no idea what's coming because I'm not an epidemiologist.
Yeah.
Those kinds of interviews, those were always the ones that really just got me going.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that I really enjoyed the most. I mean, obviously, you know, interviewing Mitch McConnell, interviewing Nancy Pelosi, all those are important. But the ones with subject matter experts where I learned a ton, mm-hmm. I was absolutely forever grateful to the experts who came on to talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, the business school professor who came on to explain the role that catalog shopping had in undermining Jim Crow. That was another one where I was like, what? So a lot of these shows, I felt like I was learning at the same time that the listener was learning, and that was really, really fun. A lot of fun.
But that's kind of, that's the magic sauce, right? So like, that's your curiosity. People feel the excitement about, you know, you finding out new information, and then they're obviously curious. So they're there along for the ride. And that's what makes it special, because I mean, curiosity is, I think I'm,
that's right.
Yeah. I'm
That's
really
right. And, you know, in 2020, I had Dr. Jay Varkey again and another scientist, and they would alternate weeks, and they would do an hour of phone calls during the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, going back to that dynamic I was describing earlier, one of the interesting dynamics was people that I knew from social media who were passionate Trump supporters would say things on social media about the pandemic that were not accurate, but they would call in to get these experts to advise them.
Hmm.
And so they professed mistrust on the one hand, and then they called in for information on the other.
Right.
And that was really, I thought that was really helpful and really good to the listeners. You know, again, it wasn't me providing hot takes. It was me sort of steering a conversation about this hopefully once in a lifetime experience.
Yeah, hopefully. Something I learned from your Twitter feed, I still call it that. I will call it that forever. Speaking of curious, folks want to Google, you define this, the connection between square dancing and quicksand porn. Do you remember that thread?
I don't remember that.
You don't remember that thread?
I don't remember that.
How could you forget that thread? You changed my life with that thread. Okay. All right, everybody. I'm going to find it. I'm going to share it with Olivier separately from this interview. And you all need to go find it. I'm going to try and find the tweet because I know it's got to exist, right? Everything exists forever. Oh my God, you literally went out of this rabbit hole. So you shared this woman's thread. She was like, by the end of this, I'm wearing a tinfoil hat. And she's like, white supremacy is involved with the square dancing and quicksand porn. Okay, well, it's true. You posted it. If you didn't, then I'm having a moment right now. It's not entirely impossible, but I'm pretty sure, 99.9% sure. Although with me, anything's possible. But quicksand porn, square dancing. And with that, thank you.
My pleasure.
I had a lot of fun. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, because I enjoyed this conversation very much. And I kept you all a really long time, which is what I do. And then say, oh my God, I kept you a really long time. But thank you.
That was great. It was fun. A fun conversation. I appreciate the diversity of topics.
Well, you know, I try and do that. It's probably because I have ADD and I can't focus on any one thing for very long. But which is fine. So with that, this concludes this episode of the Are You Effing Kidding Me podcast. You can look for new episodes every Saturday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern on all of the places where podcasts go, including the video version, which will be on YouTube. And make sure you check out my Substack, which I love Substack. It's of the same name. Are You Effing Kidding Me? Substack and podcast. Thank you, Olivier Knox.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And follow him everywhere and subscribe to his podcast. I mean, his Substack too. Okay, bye.
Are You Effing Kidding Me? Is a production of the Political Voices Network. Please visit us at politicalvoicesnetwork.com.